Hey guys, it's Jesse. Real quick, before we get today's episode started, as many of you know, we have recently announced Love Thy Neighborhood's grand finale. If you are not familiar with that big announcement, I encourage you to go back and listen. As part of that announcement, I talked about the fact that we were trying to raise $120,000 to support this grand finale. And the amazing news is this: we have actually already raised over $110,000 of that goal. So many of you made that possible through your own generosity and sacrifice. We actually only have about $8,000 left to raise, and we will be at 100%. So if you have heard this message right now, you're listening to this, and you're wondering how you can help, this is it. I mean, we are right down to the finish line. We really need a handful of folks to step up. Whether you're giving a gift of $5, $25, $100, we would be so grateful for your support. Again, we really need to reach this goal in order to make sure that we have enough time to rehome the podcast, to give severances to our staff, and to support our ministry partners one last time. The other thing is also that we are running a big sale on all of our merchandise in our store. So if you have ever wanted some different Love Thy Neighborhood stuff, whether that is Say More cards or one of our t-shirts or something else, make sure you head over to lovethyneighborhood.org and click on the store button. Everything is a sale price that we've never done before. So we could use your support. Please head over to lovethyneighborhood.org and go to the donate section to give your gift, or head over to the store and purchase something. Either one is going to help us out a lot. Okay, on to the episode.
Love Thy Neighborhood.
Okay,
oh, cool.
Oh, definitely. Awesome.
Discipleship and missions.
Mission!
For modern times.
You're listening to the Love Thy Neighborhood podcast. I'm Jesse Eubanks.
And I'm Anna Tran.
This is Things We Couldn't Say About Consumerism. In this episode, we've got three segments.
First up, Things We Couldn't Say, where we explore aspects of consumerism that we didn't have time to cover in the previous episode.
Second, Beyond Left or Right, where we explore what conservatives and progressives each get right and wrong, and how the way of Jesus is better.
And finally, What Are You Doing?, where I talk with someone from around the world to see what they're doing right now to make an impact on today's topic.
Welcome to our corner of the urban universe. Okay, first up, Things We Couldn't Say.
Okay, so we're talking about consumerism, and there was a section of the episode where we talk about Edna Ruth Byler, who started the fair trade movement. And so, you know, fair trade is all about providing a fair wage to producers of products. But what I want to talk about today is that I came across an article from The Guardian, and it essentially talked about how fair trade can be undermined and be like subverted by companies for consumers' purposes.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Here's a short summary. So fair trade changed the way that we shop, but some companies have started to abandon it and set up their own in-house imitations that basically threaten the very idea of fair trade.
Give me an example. Like, what does that look like?
Yeah. So the story in the article talks about an organization called Fair Trade International. So they're a nonprofit organization. They're aimed at helping producers in developing countries achieve better trading conditions, promote sustainability. And so it's best known for its product certification. A lot of times you'll see it as like a little label on products at a grocery store, and it basically signals to the buyer, hey, this product is fair trade.
So a lot of buyers will go in and they're like, I want to make a just purchase. And yeah. So they'll look for that label.
Yeah. So what happened was that there's this British supermarket company. They're called Sainsbury. So they sell all sorts of things like teas, produce, coffee, et cetera, et cetera. The thing is that in 2017, Sainsbury decided to source their teas from somewhere else, which were originally fair trade certified, but they essentially created their own in-house certification to determine their own measures of sustainability, their own measures of ethical practices. So they don't need to go by the official fair trade standards. They can go by their own in-house standards, which they called fairly traded. Long story short, that move really impacted just like thousands of farmers and workers in different countries. And then that sparked a whole broader debate in the UK about, you know, are independent certifications for fair traded goods effective if you're making your own standards for what fair trade means to your own company?
Okay, let me play devil's advocate just for a second here. Okay, so there are lots of organizations that start off meaning well. Now, I don't know anything about the official, like the fair trade nonprofit. Like, for all I know, every single thing that they say, this is a standard and this is a standard, is all super reasonable. But it's not hard to imagine that there could be a scenario where, because of different social pressure, times change, that they begin adding in things that really become impossible for some companies to actually adhere to because it will bankrupt the company or that they just can't.
Yeah. To be fair, there are standards that Fairtrade International has that to some people, it would be unrealistic for local farmers to be able to meet them.
Yeah.
So some people push back against Fairtrade International because their standards are too high in an already impoverished country or culture. And so that's a fair point.
But I think it's a mistake, though, for a company then to say, we'll just bring it in-house. Like, that does not seem like the right solution. Who's policing you? Like, who's actually saying these are the legitimate standards? So to me, it seems like the better option is go find yet another entity, because I'm sure that Fairtrade International, like, is not the only option.
They are not the only option. There's the Rainforest Alliance. There's other organizations. But Fairtrade International is one of the largest. So I can see how the supermarket company, in order to have more control over what they could predict their outcomes are going to be, would want to bring it in-house because it's better for business.
Yeah, you follow the dollars, you know.
Yeah.
And so if money's the bottom line, I mean, a company decides, are we successful or not according to, are we making profits?
Mm-hmm.
And so if that's the bottom line, sure. I get why they made the choice.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, I don't think they can really do it in an unbiased way.
Yeah. You know, they would claim that they are still keeping the ethical avenues open and like paying a fair wage and sourcing the products ethically. But then when it comes to ownership, it gets a little bit flipped. And so now the farmers need to meet the expectations of the company versus companies meeting expectations of farmers and local producers.
Mm.
So I just find it so interesting that with consumerism, you can take something that means really well and it kind of goes back into the consumerism machine.
Yeah. Okay, so you had said the first thing you wanted to talk about was this idea of like how fair trade can become undermined. You know, we've talked about this article. I want to talk a little bit about the idea that if like the solution to pride is humility and then the solution to greed is generosity, the solution to consumerism is supposed to be minimalism, right? I totally want to support the idea that minimalism in and of itself can be an extremely helpful thing to pursue.
Okay.
But I think that it's a huge mistake for us to think that it is the solution in and of itself.
Okay. Yeah. Tell me more.
Okay. So there's a website, Redeeming Productivity. So first off, this minimalism discourages the love of money. I think that that is totally true. I don't need as much money if I don't have to own as many things, if I don't need to purchase as many things. It also encourages contentment. What I have is enough. Like, it's enough. And I don't want to take on more unless I have to. Minimalism affirms those things. I think it encourages thoughtfulness. Instead of us just sort of like living habitually, buying compulsively, just going along with the culture, it puts us in a space where we actually really need to be thoughtful about the way we live. And I think that's intentionality. And I think that that is totally in line with the way of Jesus.
Yeah. Like those are all components to how Jesus lived and the teachings that Jesus taught.
Yep. Okay. But then this blog, Redeeming Productivity, it goes on to talk about this, where it is not in line with the gospel. So here's where I want to push back. So one thing that minimalism can never do for us is actually make us happy. It's wonderful, but it does not possess the actual ability to give us joy and give us hope and give us happiness. Here's a quote from the website. Minimalism is a philosophy that says you can be happy if you stop looking for happiness in stuff. And while there is lots of praise for minimalism's rejection of consumerism and materialism, the truth is if happiness is the aim, minimalism won't get you all the way there.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. Advertising works like this. Anna, you have a problem, and I'm now here to give you a solution. And minimalism goes, guys, that's a lie. Don't believe it. But minimalism in and of itself ends up following the same formula. You have a problem with consumerism. Mm. Here's the solution.
Yeah. I have a problem with having too much stuff.
Yeah.
The solution, get rid of my stuff.
Yep.
Put my stuff somewhere else. Have less stuff.
And you're going to smile and you're going to feel fulfilled and you're going to, you know, feel great.
I like how the quote says, like, it won't get you all the way there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it'll get you part of the way there.
I don't think we should jettison it.
Yeah.
But I think it's an exaggeration and a fabrication if we believe it's going to be the real solution. Minimalism can definitely help us create room for us to have more capacity to be filled with the right things. But minimalism in and of itself cannot do that for us.
Yeah. And I think it brings a question then, when you are making room, what are you going to fill that new space with?
Mm-hmm.
The goal in like the Christian life is to be filled like with the Holy Spirit, to be filled with the good things of God. And so we can make space and then fill it with things that are idolatrous. Like
mm-hmm.
maybe we got rid of a lot of stuff, but maybe we fill that time with pursuing like a side hustle, or we fill that time with pursuing success in another arena.
Yeah. Yeah. Can I give you like a history lesson here?
Okay,
so what I'm about to share, it comes from the Bema podcast. I think it's season 3, maybe.
Okay.
It's this series called The Silent Years. The Bema podcast basically does this really in-depth cultural analysis. Like, what is the context of these passages? When they were written?
In the Bible.
In the Bible, what was going on in the broader culture? Why were they written for this specific context? Anyway, so the host, Marty Solomon, he does this in-depth breakdown of the 5 Jewish subcultures in the New Testament. And I think 2 of them are really, really relevant to what we're talking about right now. So basically what happens, Rome comes in, Rome takes over the nation of Israel. They are now conquered. And along with Rome's arrival comes Hellenism. Hellenism is this idea that the good life is about enjoying good things. It's like, I want great education and I want to be able to go to a great gym and like take care of my body, and I want to eat great food and I want to enjoy the arts and I want to go to these plays and enjoy entertainment.
Okay. Like, so they're consuming a lot.
So it's like consumption. It's all these good things. So part of what first century Jews had to do was decide, how do we feel about that? How do we feel about this arrival of this sort of consumeristic culture that's around us? And basically, there's this schism that takes place. And so part of what happens is that there's a whole bunch of Jewish folks that are totally fine with it. So so these folks are known as Herodians. They are living in Jerusalem. They're living in the south. They're hanging out with the Sadducees. The Sadducees also are going to fall into this. It is just like God wants us to enjoy lots of good things. So it's like they're living the fat life. But then there's all these other sects that are like, no, 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 no. Like, that is not what God has called us to. He's called us to take care of each other. He's called us to simplicity. He has called us to have all things in common. So these folks head north, and one of these groups is the Pharisees. They lived very simply. They took care of each other. There was a highly communal view of life. And literally, archaeologists will look at the homes that Herodians owned and then Pharisees owned. They could not be more different. Herodian homes, lots of art, mosaic.
Like lavish.
Lavish, mosaic floors, you know, artwork on the walls. Then you go to the Pharisees and they're very simple homes, extremely simple, much more people living in a single home. And I think that there's a sense in which both sides got some parts right and some parts wrong. I think that the Herodians were right that God does want us to be able to enjoy certain good gifts that he gives to us. And is there anything inherently wrong with wanting to go to a play or wanting to go swim in a pool? Or there's nothing wrong with those things, but there can become a love of pleasure that comes with that. You know, the Pharisees had this great desire to honor God and to
follow,
you know,
law.
To follow the law and to honor the Torah, and they really wanted to obey God. And as part of that, they wanted to be a communal people. But there was something else that happened. They became rigid as they did. They were like, this is the only way to follow God. And if you don't follow God this way, then you are a sinner and you're part of the problem. And there was a militant sort of tone that came with it. So that then when Jesus shows up on the scene, like, they can't even see that God is in front of them. So you end up with almost like a prosperity gospel kind of culture versus this, you know, life of simplicity and minimalism. But in both cases, they kind of ended up missing the mark. So when we talk about this idea of minimalism not being enough, you know, for me, I can't help but think of the Pharisees. I think there were a lot of things the Pharisees got right. The reason that Jesus ended up preaching to the Pharisees so much is because I think they had a lot of margin in their life to be able to hear him. But simultaneously, there was a hardness of heart where they believed they had found the solution and they did not need him. Okay, stay with us because when we come back, we will continue our conversation about consumerism. And in particular, we're going to talk about consumer Christianity. Is it a worldview that's more dominant than actually atheism and postmodernism? Well, we'll talk about that after the break. Stay with us. Are you tired of dull, awkward conversations at the dinner table, family get-togethers, or office gatherings? Well, we can help. Check out our Say More conversation cards, your ticket to turning mundane chats into meaningful connections. With 100 thoughtfully curated questions, Say More takes the guesswork out of engaging conversations. Use it during family dinners, date nights, parties, or even in the workplace. Watch how one simple question can spark endless, enriching discussions. The deck includes lighthearted questions such as, what is your most hated chore and why? As well as, what's your all-time favorite dessert? It also includes thoughtful questions like, what aspects about faith do you find difficult? And when you meet God, what do you want to say to him? Convenient and portable, Say More is your on-the-go solution for building better relationships. To pick up your deck of Say More cards, head over to lovethyneighborhood.org and click on the store button. Again, head over to lovethyneighborhood.org and click on the store button. Better relationships are just a question away. Get your Say More deck today and see where one good question can take you. You're listening to the Love That Neighborhood podcast. I'm Jesse Eubanks.
And I'm Anna Tran.
So before the break, we were talking about different ideas around consumerism. And now we specifically want to talk about this issue of consumer Christianity in the United States. So in 2009, author Sky Jatani wrote a book called The Divine Commodity. And in an interview, he actually addressed why he wrote the book. He said that a lot of people will talk about the threat of postmodernism or even the threat of modernity, hedonism, all these isms, atheism. And very few people in the church are talking about consumerism as being the dominant worldview that shapes the perceptions of everyone today. It's the water we're swimming in that nobody's acknowledging.
Ooh, some big words there.
Yeah.
I think a quote from the book would be helpful here. In the book, he says, Richard Halverson, former chaplain of the United States Senate, is said to have observed that, in the beginning, the church was a fellowship of men and women centered on the living Christ. Then the church moved to Greece, where it became a philosophy. Then it moved to Rome, where it became an institution. Next, it moved to Europe, where it became a culture. And finally, it moved to America, where it became an enterprise.
That is an unsettling quote.
Yeah, enterprise is where we're going to land here. When I think of enterprise, I think a project to move forward, to like conquer something.
Yeah, it's like a whole structure. It's a system. It's got goals and metrics, and there's a vision. And I don't think that inherently any of that is wrong, but there's a sense in which enterprises are led by profit and loss. There's a sense in which we're either making gains or we're making losses, and everything is sort of determined by how do we grow this thing and how do we ensure that it's never going to shrink?
Yeah.
Okay, so a core component of consumerism is commodification. So economic term, commodification is this idea that something's value is actually not found in its inherent quality, but in what it can be traded for or exchanged for. It is all just about its utilitarian, like, can I get money from this? Like, is it serving a purpose for me?
It's like the profit loss thing. Will I gain from it or will I lose from it?
Yes. Here's what happens. We totally bring that into our faith in God. God ends up becoming an entity to be used, and his purpose is to dispense good things to me and to fix my problems.
So it's like, how can I use God to make my life better now?
Yes. A lot of times what happens is that our churches inadvertently even end up sort of framing God in that way. Like, God has this mission and he wants you to be a part of it. And we're going to go do this and we're going to accomplish this. And so instead of us sort of even just going, God is beautiful in and of himself, we go, God is beautiful because of what he does. Mm-hmm. And so we bring this sort of commodification idea over to our faith.
Mm. I think about enterprise or even companies, they always have a vision and a mission. So like the mission language is something we're very familiar with. Like we have a mission to go do something and achieve something. And so then I'm part of God's mission to achieve something and achieve some sort of like gain or profit.
Can I loop back for just for 1 second, this idea of a consumeristic sort of approach versus a minimalist approach?
Sure.
And so it is legitimate, and we are doing it. I think it needs to be done, a critique of when the church sort of has this hyper profit and loss sort of approach to things. And I think that all needs to be critiqued. The mistake that I sometimes see is that there are Christians that look at that and go, that is not the way of Jesus, so I'm walking away from it. And what they do is they try to flatten everything. There's no hierarchy. There's no key leader. There's no weekly structure to how we do things. There's no liturgy. And it's an attempt to go, we don't want to be like that. But I feel like that is also a mistake, because we look in the New Testament and we do see that as the church matured, there was structure.
Organization.
There's organization. Like, there's a way to do things that are still beneficial. So again, I think we're coming back to this thing of like consumeristic Christianity is definitely a problem, but minimalistic Christianity, for lack of a better term, is also not a real solution. In my experience, when I look at a lot of folks that stay in sort of these minimalistic cultures prolonged many, many, many years, what happens over time is that their faith starts to wither a little bit because there's no push and pull. There's no challenge. There's no rhythm.
It's not robust. It's like a thin.
Yeah.
Kind of like
so
faith.
They could have great community. And I think that part's wonderful. But there is a structure to church. So if these huge sort of hyper business models are taking what we see in the New Testament and like taking it to ends that we may say, like, Jesus never intended that. I also think that stepping backwards and going into this thing where there's no structure, well, that can't be the solution either.
Yeah. So I think part of the beauty of the church is, like you said, there's this push and pull. There's conflict.
Yeah.
There's things that we need to process in community with each other. And we can't do that unless there's some rub.
Yeah.
And if there, you know, is this kind of this like minimalistic faith where we're trying to like flatten everything, there's going to be less rub, so there'll be less conflict, but there is less opportunity to experience grace and to experience the fullness of life that Jesus lays out in Scripture.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've talked about this huge issue of consumerism, and we've talked about sort of the ways that it can show up in our lives. And so I think that we need to talk some about what are practices that I, as a Christian, as a follower of Jesus, what does it mean to walk with him? What does it mean to pursue something that looks more like Jesus? What would you say?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're not going to find the word consumerism per se in the Bible, but Jesus taught a lot about how to live the good life. And it actually includes things like this, silence and solitude. In our society, there's so much noise, so many phone notifications, billboard ads. There's just a lot of things vying for our attention. And so Jesus really modeled silence and solitude. So this is a good practice to incorporate maybe on a weekly basis, maybe on a monthly retreat, but essentially removing yourself from distractions to have an opportunity to hear from God.
Yeah. I've heard somebody say that silence and solitude is the container in which all other spiritual disciplines are held, because it is the space where we sort things out. It is the space where we bring things before God. All of that has to happen in an unhurried and uncluttered and non-anxious environment.
Yeah. I like what you said about unhurried and uncluttered. So silence and solitude is like an opportunity for us to be filled intentionally with hearing from God. That space is really important and a great way to push back against consumerism, because if we're being filled with the good things of the Lord, then our overconsumption desires won't rear its head.
Yeah. It's sort of like if you eat good calories, you know, you start to recognize that empty calories don't fill in this exact same way.
Ah, those Doritos, they really get you.
So I think adjacent to silence and solitude would also be just the practice of Sabbath. That's one that, man, it took me a long time to get to this place where I really valued Sabbath and understood it, like why it was so important, especially when I was younger and I had a lot of energy and I had a lot of things to do in life and so forth. Sabbath lets me sort of get perspective on my life. It's this prolonged space of rest, and you just kind of go, do I remember who I am to him? Mm. And out of remembering our identity, that decides the way that I want to live as well.
Yeah. And in particular, the resting from work and vocation, I think, is something I want to highlight. The pastors at my church, they often say, like, identity precedes function.
Yeah.
And it's so, like, ingrained in me, at least, that it's like, I am my function. I find purpose and fulfillment through work. And it's not just work in my vocation, but doing house projects or doing things that make me feel productive and effective.
Yeah, because for Americans, we're like, you're as valuable as your productivity. Mm. So if you're getting a lot of things done, you have a lot of value.
Yeah. So Sabbath really pushes back against the commodification thing. So we're not commodities to produce and be effective, but we're inherently valuable. And so we can rest and delight and enjoy in the life that God has given us.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So silence and solitude, Sabbath. You had another one?
Yeah. So last one, fasting. Fasting from food, but you could also modify it. Maybe fasting from media for a day or maybe an entire week. You don't need to do a 40 days, 40 night fast like Jesus did or something. That's pretty extreme. But for example, like taking a day and turning your phone off for one whole hour out of the day and then seeing how you feel as a result of that. And so that's like a fasting from media, fasting from like digital inputs. But, you know, the original fasting obviously is fasting from food. In this practice, we are essentially placing ourselves in a situation where we have need and we're not filling it ourselves. We're relying on God to meet those needs. And so that is pretty counterintuitive, I think, for the culture that we live in.
Yeah. It is so countercultural for us as Americans because we are not a people that deny ourselves.
Yeah. Fasting is intentional denial, which is pretty foreign for a lot of us.
Yeah. Well, those were some of the things that we could not say about consumerism in the last episode. Stay with us because when we come back, I will be putting Anna through our segment Beyond Left or Right. Stay with us. For many young adults, you have had a blueprint provided for your entire life. You've known where you'll live. You've known where you'll go to school, what the expectations are. However, the formula that you have been following is about to come to an end. The laundry, the dishes, and the realness is all about to pile up because you are crossing the threshold into adulthood. And for a lot of you, this is terrifying. There's good news. The good news is that you're going to survive. The bad news is that you could waste precious years of your life fumbling around in the dark, unsure of what next steps to take or who to take them with. But you don't have to be confused. We've created a free resource to help you. It's called the Quarter Life Roadmap, a 5-day guide for 20-somethings to discover who you are, what you want, and where you're going. In this guide, I'm going to help you understand which stage of emerging adulthood you're in and what that means. I'm going to help you understand the traits, experiences, and support systems you already have in life, how to identify your calling and your passions, and how to build your strategy for life. And finally, I'm going to help you learn how to face your fears with the courage of Christ. This highly interactive process is customized to your life and your experiences. To get this free resource, head over to lovethyneighborhood.org and click on the free resources button. Again, head over to lovethyneighborhood.org and click on the free resources button. You're going to get access to this as well as a ton of other free resources. Listen, you don't have to wander through your 20s. You need a map to guide you. It's time to reveal what that map is. Love That Neighborhood podcast, Jesse Eubanks.
Anna Tran.
And now it's time for Beyond Left or Right. So in this segment of our show, I'm going to ask Anna to put today's topic, consumerism, through three questions. What is the conservative view on consumerism? What is the progressive view on consumerism? And what is the Christian view on consumerism? So here's how it works. And I'm going to ask you these three questions. When you are summarizing opposing views, please be charitable. Present both the conservative and progressive views fairly and objectively rather than trying to make it look foolish. Then for the final question, tell us which elements both conservatives and progressives each get right and how the Christian view challenges and surpasses both. So are you ready?
Yeah. And what I want to clarify here, typically we would do this segment and think about conservative and progressive in like political terms, but that's not what we're going to do here. So we're going to think about it in terms of conservative is like I'm conserving my consumption, and then progressive is like I'm feeding my consumption. So those are the two spectrums we're going to be working with here.
Okay. Well, with that in mind, first question, what is the conservative view on consumerism?
So I would say a conservative view on consumerism is that you're slower and more cautious to consume things like products and services. So folks with more conservative views on consumerism are more hesitant to get on the latest trends. A lot of times it's out of fear, but at the same time, there is just a high value put on traditional ways of living or being. For example, someone can be conservative in their adoption of like a smartphone. They instead still have a landline or they have a flip phone because they're more fearful or concerned about how the phone will like affect their life. And then on the other side, you know, high value of something like tradition. For example, a traditional church, quote unquote traditional church, puts a lot of emphasis on older ways of worship. So that could mean really liturgical because it's something they have put such a high honor and value to. They want to preserve that and not adapt new ways of experiencing the worship service. And in some expressions, there's a high value of minimalism. And I'm not talking about, you know, that clean Pinterest-like aesthetic, but minimalism as in we only will consume like the bare minimum of what we need, and anything extra we want to abstain from. And I think to sum it up, it's like what you were talking about earlier in the episode, Jesse. A more conservative view on consumerism is like the Pharisees. you know, there's a lot of emphasis on what's good for the community and not just for the individual.
Yeah. And just to clarify, when you say, because a lot of times we say, like the Pharisees, we say that in a sermon, we always mean it in a purely negative way. You're actually using it in
a positive way.
In a neutral to positive way.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the conservative view on consumerism. What is the progressive view on consumerism?
Okay. Progressive view, feeding consumption. So there's a high adoption and a quickness to consume goods and services, and that's before knowing if they're going to be good or bad. It's like, this thing is for me, I'm going to buy it, I'm going to take it. So for example, like fast fashion, there's like a desire to be on trend with whatever style is in. And so there's a quickness to buy, you know, the clothes that are going to be relevant to whatever culture you're a part of. And another example is with technology. And this is not necessarily a bad thing. For example, whatever new VR technology is out there, or even AI technology, buying and engaging with that, for many people, it's genuinely out of curiosity. There's such like intrigue and discovery that people are eager to learn about and to see how they can incorporate that and make their lives richer and more beautiful.
Early adopters.
So there's this like cutting edge value. And I think the way that, you know, it can spill into churches is that churches will put high value on being very relevant on things like social media platforms, video streaming, so that we can be culturally relevant. And I would say also how this leaks into our churches is that church can tend to operate as a business because there's an eagerness to dive into this enterprise spirit.
Mm. Okay, so let's talk some then about the Christian view on consumerism. What does the conservative view get right?
Yeah, I think in the conservative view, there's a benefit to waiting and seeing how something will affect us in the long run. Just essentially putting a pause on pursuing something in favor of intentionality. And at the same time, I think there's this honoring and treasuring of traditional ways of doing things. In this case, goodness outweighs efficiency.
Okay, so what does the progressive view of consumerism get right?
Yeah, I think there's this really beautiful spirit of creativity and discovery when it comes to being on the cutting edge of consuming things. So, you know, we're creative people, and there's like an earnest desire to explore and learn how new things can bring life into the world.
Okay, so in light of that, what is the Christian view?
Okay, so Christian view would say God gives us everything that we need for life and fulfillment. So we don't need to be on trend or be anxious about buying extra things to make us happy. God has given us enough. And at the same time, God is abundant in the gifts that he provides. And so those gifts are for us to delight in and to enjoy. So it's beautiful, and it's part of the Christian life to enjoy the abundance of God. We can enjoy all forms of expressions of common grace in God's gifts.
Okay, so how does the Christian view challenge the conservative view?
Yeah, similarly to what I said before, you know, there's a lot of beauty to experience and enjoy in the world. You know, there's fullness of life within God's world. So we don't have to be afraid of not knowing how things will affect us, because there are many things that are just for enjoyment and delight.
Okay, so how does the Christian view challenge the progressive view?
Yeah, I think that just because something is new or could make our lives more efficient or easier, it doesn't necessarily mean it's holistically better. There is a lot of value in old ways of doing things.
Yeah, I think in so many ways, Anna, like what you're talking about is the spectrum, right? There's a spectrum of how we relate to our purchases and our money and the things we consume and everything from media to church to relationships. And I think the big thing is that we need to have self-awareness. What are my tendencies? Do I tend to be somebody that tends to sort of automatically consume without much thought? Or do I tend to be somebody that is hyper-intentional and sometimes even intentional to the point that I actually end up withholding and bypassing moments and experiences that God wanted to give me that I could have enjoyed? So I think that both sides need to have self-awareness and then need to know, okay, God, if that's my tendency, how do I follow you amidst that tendency? What is it like to, you know, have a good relationship with the way that I consume things? Okay, and now it's time for What Are You Doing? Where Anna talks with somebody from around the world to see what they're doing right now to make an impact on today's topic.
So the other week, I went in person to visit a local nonprofit in town. I talked with Karen Arrow. She's the founder of Maya Collection. Their mission is to inspire and equip refugee women to use their God-given talents to thrive as artisans in their local communities. Through neighborhood outreach, Maya Collection provides encouragement, training, mentoring, and employment opportunities for women and teens. All right, here's my conversation with Karen Arrow.
Well, is there a spot we can sit down?
Yes.
And then
yes.
Share more. Sorry.
So we want to go kind of a quiet place.
Yeah.
Are you going to want to go to the shop? Do you want to sit in the shop?
Oh, that's in the shop. Let's see it.
Okay.
Real quick.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So to get a little bit of history about how Maya Collection started, I'll take us back to 2009. Karen was working for a different nonprofit, and they were looking for women to join a new program they were developing.
We were looking for more students for a life skills program for single moms.
She went to a nearby neighborhood to see if there were some mothers who would be interested in joining this life skills class. And as she's walking around this neighborhood, she ran into a woman from Nepal.
And then she invited me in to have tea, and I got to know her, and she became a friend.
The woman came to the six-week class, and to Karen's surprise, she wasn't the only refugee woman who had come.
And by the end of the class, we had about 15 refugee women as part of the class.
As Karen got to know many of the other women, learning about their families, their daily lives, she started noticing something.
I realized how they had financial needs.
Although there were other family members who worked to earn income, she learned that a lot of times it still wasn't enough. So an idea came to mind.
And I thought, well, why don't we help them make crafts and sell those for them?
So Karen jumped right into problem-solving mode. She asked a small group of these women.
I asked them, what can you do? What's your skills? And they were from Nepal, and they all knew how to knit. So we started making scarves.
After some scarves were made, Karen gathered them up, went to a local craft show, and set up a booth to see if she could sell any of these scarves. And by the end of the day, she actually had sold all the scarves.
Basically, I took all the profits from the scarves and gave them to the women, and they were just thrilled. They were so excited.
And so Karen really wanted to help more refugees with this process of teaching them crafting skills and then selling those products to provide income for these women. So she sets up her own nonprofit to keep this cycle going. And in honor of the women from Nepal, Karen knew exactly what to name this new organization.
So we are Maya Collection. Maya means love in Nepali, so a collection of love.
And 15 years later, Karen is still working with refugee women, now from many different countries.
So our mission statement is to encourage, empower, and equip local refugee women and teens through mentoring and skills training to help them flourish in our community.
The organization has grown, and now there are a few additional staff members and a bigger group of volunteers. So Maya Collection has two parts to the organization. First, a business side, and second, a ministry side. On the business side, Maya Collection sells all sorts of products. Handbags, leather goods.
Jewelry and sewing products and embroidery and all kinds of things. In fact, we don't even knit anymore.
They go to craft shows and...
We sell online, we wholesale, and then we have our own little boutique.
Managing the business side is really important because it's what allows Maya Collection to fairly pay the women who make the products.
We basically look at how many hours they spend working on a product, and then we convert that to $10 to $12 an hour. Now, if we hire them, it's different. We also have some that we hire. We hire a few at a time. We pay them more than that.
Karen told me that it's challenging to compete with bigger for-profit companies.
See, these are all handmade. And there's a big difference between that and something's been made in some factory with a machine overseas. There's a big difference.
The big difference is that Maya Collection products will naturally cost more than something you'd find at Target or Walmart. Because Maya Collection is all about caring for refugees, the profits made are all funneled towards paying the artisans and towards ministry efforts.
We gather groups of women together and we spend time with them and we do things like read the Bible, and then we also go to their homes. We go to weddings and sometimes school things, and we've had some teaching driving lessons kind of opportunities and things like that.
In many ways, the staff of Maya Collection do life together with artisans and their families, sharing and celebrating joys, but also...
And we've gone through some hard times with some of our artisans. One of our artisans lost her baby and had a stillborn, and so we were there for her at her funeral. And so we have to go through some hard times with some of them. Some of them lose family members to death, and we try to be there for them. And once again, we have a limitation. We can't do it all, but we do what we feel like we can.
Karen told me she's had the honor of seeing refugee women learn how to navigate and grow in the United States. For example, one young woman she met came to my collection as an artisan.
Then she became a volunteer. Then she became an intern. And then she left and went to college. And now she's got a job and she is now on our board. So we've watched her grow from the very beginning and we watched her progress. I think that's so exciting. And she's just an amazing young woman. She's still in her young 20s.
The reality is that because product sales is not the only priority of Maya Collection, there are limitations to the amount of people they can serve.
In today's economy, it's really hard. We are losing some of our artisans because they can't make enough through Maya Collection, because we can't hire all of them.
But for Karen, return on investment isn't necessarily about increasing sales. Maya Collection products are a vehicle to bring good into the lives of refugees. And recently, Maya Collection has started something they call the Lotus Collection, a teen program for girls from the community.
They're from refugee homes. They're refugees themselves. We have at least 30 teens that we work with, which is huge.
They gather in the evenings on Wednesdays to share a meal. And the staff teaches the girls craft-making skills similar to the artisans.
They are now making our earrings, our necklaces, and our bracelets.
The girls are also paid for the items they make. And in addition to making jewelry, the volunteers and staff teach about safety and life skills, like relating well to social media.
And talk about dating and careers and future and goal setting. We want them to look down the road and what do they want to do when they graduate from high school. And some of them go to college, they set careers, and it's really exciting to watch that.
Zooming out, for Karen, Maya Collection isn't just about teaching practical skills and providing a means for income. It's about communicating to both artisans and the teenagers that they are loved and cherished.
We help them feel like they're important and how God created them and they're beautiful and what they make is beautiful.
When I asked Karen where she hopes Maya Collection will be in the future,
as far as an end game, I just really depend on the Lord. I do feel like He has directed us. He's directed our steps. I can't go too far ahead, but I do pretty much go year by year. It's constant prayer, constantly asking for wisdom. But I really did not expect to be doing it at this age.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. Make sure to leave a review for the show wherever it is that you listen to podcasts. When you leave a review, we actually do read those. They are a huge encouragement to us, and they help other people discover the show. So please take a moment, leave a review, let us know what you think. Special thanks to Tracy Beckley and Karen Arrow. To learn more about Maya Collection, go to mayacollection.org.
Senior producer and host is Jesse Eubanks. Co-host is me, Anna Tran.
Anna Tran is our producer and audio editor.
Music is from Lee Rosevere and Murphy DX.
This show is brought to you by Love Thy Neighborhood. If you want a hands-on experience of missions in our modern times, come serve with Love Thy Neighborhood. Love Thy Neighborhood offers summer and year-long missions internships for young adults ages 18 to 30. Bring social change with the gospel by working with an innovative nonprofit and serving your urban neighbors.
Experience community like never before as you live and do ministry with other Christian young adults. Grow in your faith by walking in the life and lifestyle of Jesus and being part of a vibrant, healthy church. Get more info at lovethyneighborhood.org.
Which of these was a neighbor to the man in need? The one who showed mercy. Jesus tells us, go and do likewise.